coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Realm, coming to you in a pre-recorded fashion. This is one of the last few weeks that I am on the road full-time with AV engineering, things like that. Very, very much looking forward to here in a couple weeks. We will actively be live broadcasting from the Folk Monster Festival in Falk, Arkansas. That's going to be super fun. Cannot wait to see our good friend Craig Woolheater up there, who is hosting the conference and putting it on, as well as Daniel Allen Jones. I'm sure King Gerhardt, people like that will be there. Stop on by, check it out on Eventbrite, folks. Get your tickets. June 18th is the actual festival. Come on out to Falk, Arkansas, and check that out. It's going to be super fun. While you're online checking everything about the Falk Monster Festival out, as well as the legend of the Falk Monster, stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can tune in to all of our live coverage from events such as that, the upcoming MUFON Symposium in Denver, other great conferences coming up. We had a great time out at the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Roadshow. Stop on by. CuriousRealm.com is the website. While you're there, make sure to check out secretofeverything.com. That is, of course, the website of our amazing sponsor, Dr. Kimberly McGeorge. She is your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness expansion. Secretofeverything.com is the website, as well as the amazing WebWorks Wireless. That is who all of our live streams are brought to you by. Our direct live stream to our website, as well as the live stream that we have going out from all of these amazing events, such as the Falk Monster Festival. Before we bring up our guest today, Tobe Johnson and Brett Eichenberger, who are the producers of A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed, an amazing new documentary that has literally just hit platforms. Stop on by and check it out on Amazon. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it online at bigfootdoc.com. We will be talking to those guys about the making of this documentary, how they came into the world of this research, what brought them together as researchers, and more here in just a second. Before we do, let's of course visit the news of the week. News of the week brought to you by our Curious Realm Facebook group. Stop on by, join the conversation, folks. This week in the news, woman dies after bison tosses her 10 feet in the air in Yellowstone National Park. That coming out of Yahoo.com. And, you know, you hear it all the time, like, don't play with the wildlife. Like, seriously, man, don't play with the wildlife. Don't try to go pet bison. Things like that. They are dangerous animals. Out of YahooNews.com as well, meet a 34-year-old with a $250,000 student debt after 13 years of barely keeping up with her interest payments. Some great conversation on that one. Out of Fox News, attempted Reagan assassin John Hinckley Jr. to get unconditional release confirmed by judges. And out of the Dallas Observer, felony marijuana possession charge dropped against licensed hemp grower in Navarro County. That is just some of the news brought to you by our Curious Realm Facebook group. Stop on by, join the conversation. Let's welcome to the show the producers of A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. Let's go ahead and bring up their video real quick, and we can see a little bit of the trailer.
I'm looking at this giant figure, huge, 8 feet tall, non-human gait. I'm trying to classify what this thing is, but it's not real. And I know what it is, but what it is not real.
The arms of these things went well below their knees. Unbelievably long arms. when I looked up, there was a young male looking at me.
Something's going around my tent.
It stops behind me, and then contact.
We tried. We really tried to get pictures, but these things seemed to outfox us.
Something is leaving footprints.
As you start utilizing the data and you start seeing the data tell the whole story unfolds right before your eyes.
The way it pulled its little one, its young, behind it with its arm. I mean, I can't even put it in words. It was so unreal.
Knowing about
that
them.
Is just some of the trailer for A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. Welcome to the show, Tobe Johnson and Brett Eichenberger. How are you guys doing today?
Doing fantastic. Fantastic, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Man, I am excited to talk to you guys. Number one, we have been going out to a lot of Bigfoot road shows, things like that here in the great state of Texas. And we are all about cryptozoology research here. We've interviewed numerous people like, you know, our good friend Craig Woolheater, as well as King Gerhardt, stuff like that. And to know that sightings still regularly happen across the United States and across the globe is phenomenal. And to know that the research is still kind of looked at side-eyed is kind of sad. So before we get into the film and what brought y'all to producing that, I guess let's start off with Brett. You actually run Resonance Productions, things like that. Tell us what kind of brought you into the world of Bigfoot research. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your filmmaking.
Yeah, so I've been making films since I was a little kid, and which goes back over 30 years. So, you know, and I've always been interested in the paranormal world, if you will. As a child, I would sit and watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind on repeat, and which incidentally is a commonality between Tobe and I. But, you know, the Spielberg films, all those different things that captivated my imagination. And when I was in second grade, after watching E.T., I realized I wanted to be a director. So this fascination with the paranormal and the unseen and everything really originated in films, in movies of the 80s. And growing up in the state of Oregon, you know, it was around us. You know, we often thought of Bigfoot off and looked outside the window, you know, on long road trips into the woods, into the deep, dark woods, wondering if there was a Bigfoot looking back at me. And so from the filmmaking, from making films, I just had an interest in stories in general. And, you know, it was something that my wife, Jill, and I, who's a producer and writer on A Flash of Beauty, something that brought us together. And our love of the paranormal eventually got us to, long story short, got us to a Bigfoot conference back in 2012. And we got to know some of the players in the Bigfoot world, such as Peter Byrne, Ron Moorhead, Todd Neese, who has become a close friend of ours. And we had always thought, you know, we have an in if we ever wanted to make a Bigfoot documentary. And we had ideas on how we wanted to make it. We wanted to do it different than what we had seen. And so the opportunity presented itself back in June of 2020, during the middle of the pandemic. We thought, you know what, if there was ever a time to do it, now is the time, you know, because work had pretty much dried up. My production company does commercials and short films and different things. And so we thought, you know what, let's do it. Let's get out there. And, you know, there was a little bit of stimulus money we were all getting. And so we had a little bit of that and we hit the road. And, you know, this is a film that was self-funded. We didn't have investors or anything else. And that gave us a tremendous amount of freedom to kind of go and talk to whoever we wanted to, when we wanted to, how we wanted to. And the rest is history, I should say.
And, you know, I think that your last statement there, especially about being self-funded.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Allergies. It cannot be understated because, yes, whenever you bring in other executive producers, whenever you bring in other people for funding, sometimes it can definitely detract from what you're trying to do with the film, especially if they are a major investor. You may have to edit things or change things according to what they want to do. So the fact that you were able to maintain full creative control over this project is pretty incredible.
Yeah, we were very lucky. You know, and it wasn't easy. I'm not going to lie. It definitely wasn't easy. And you know, obviously, we still had to pay the bills, keep the lights on. And so this wasn't something that we shot continuously. We shot it when we had the funds to shoot it. And considering we started shooting it 2 years ago, we turned the documentary around pretty quick. And, you know, I've been doing this so long that I can be my own editor and my own sound guy, my own color guy. And that's what's great about being a videographer and kind of cutting my teeth in that world is, you know, you learn to juggle a whole bunch of balls and make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. And a couple more questions for you, Brett, before we move on to Tobe and learn about his involvement with this project and how he came to it. Earlier, you mentioned that, of course, growing up in the Pacific Northwest, that this was something that had been resident. Like, I mean, Oregon is one of the only states where there are active signs saying that Bigfoot is protected in the woods. With it being out there, was it the fact that anybody in your family had experiences or had sightings?
If anybody in my family has had any sort of experiences or sightings, they're holding out on me.
they were not much help in the diary part of the film.
Yeah, but you know, who knows? We interviewed Dr. Michael Adams, who says there could be a huge population of folks out there that have suppressed it so much that you would never know if they had a sighting. So
sure,
that's a fact. I mean, you know, who knows?
Absolutely, that is something that we talk about regularly. Because while we love to talk about these topics, more than anything, we love to demystify these topics. And yes, everybody thinks that, like, oh, I would love to have a UFO sighting. Oh, I would love to have a Bigfoot sighting. Oh, I would love to have a paranormal experience. Until the aftermath of that experience comes into your life. It's not always the easiest thing to go back to your buddies at the camp or go back to your family after a weekend at the camp and be like, so guess what I saw? Even your wife may think you're a crazy person.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's one of the goals that we identified early on when we started making this film, is that we wanted to tell stories that gave people the confidence that they needed to really start talking about maybe some of these strange experiences. You know, something that sticks out in my mind, this isn't in the film, but towards the end of the film, I think I was still editing it and I was getting pretty close to the final edit, and our furnace went out. This is in January.
Ooh, that's rough.
And the guy that came over to fix our furnace, you know, he's looking around the house and we've got all kinds of Sasquatch stuff, right? You know, we've gotten gifts from folks and we picked things up from, you know, places like Hanobi, Oklahoma that we went to and whatnot. Sure. And he looks around and says, what's with the Bigfoot stuff? And he said, well, you know, we're doing this film, so on and so forth. And he kind of looks around just to make sure there was nobody else in the room. And he says, oh yeah, my grandfather saw one up in the Oregon Coast Range back in the late 60s. He was sitting on a ridge, sitting in a chair with his gun, waiting for an elk to walk by, which sounds more like fishing than hunting to me. But anyways, the furnace guy goes on to tell us the story. His grandfather was the local sheriff in a small community outside of Portland. And as he's sitting there waiting for an elk to walk by, sure enough, a Bigfoot walks by. And it was relatively close. I believe it was like anywhere between 50 and 100 yards. And his grandfather leapt up out of his chair, left his gun, got in his pickup truck, and sped home, vowing to never go hunting again. And
wow.
When he told his grandson this story, he says, don't ever ask me about it again. This is the only time you're ever going to know about it. You know, this is a guy that was the sheriff,
yeah,
he was a veteran, and that was that.
Yep.
You know, so that was an interesting conversation, and that's been kind of a theme with a few folks that we wanted to interview for this film, but would not go on camera.
Interesting. Yeah, and I could see that. I could definitely see that. I mean, we regularly have people like Terry Lovelace on the show, who he was a former state prosecutor. And he is a full-on experiencer, abductee, everything else, come to find out years later, and has come out with his story. But he held it inside for a good 30-something years because of the position that he had. It's not always the wine and roses that you hear about, and it's not always the fanfare from the media. Things have changed a little bit in the UFO community, but even still, when it comes to Sasquatch, when it comes to cryptids, things like that, not so much. And the one thing that I bring up regularly, whenever people doubt anything, and they're like, oh, well, you know, we've developed most of America now. We would have run across a Bigfoot if there was one. I normally bring up the most recent image of the United States at night from NASA, where about 50% of it is still black. It's like, yeah, it looks like we've developed a lot of it. And oddly enough, if you take the map of like Sasquatch sightings, things like that, and overlay it, they're almost the same. It's pretty wild because, when you get up into Oklahoma, Washington State, things like that, you still have rainforest, that kind of stuff. There is growth so dense that, even bear, things like that don't go in it.
Oh, yeah. Tobe and I were just in the rainforest days ago. Up in the extreme northwestern Washington State, up in the Olympic National Park. And, you know, that's a long drive to and from Portland where we live. And you know, looking through those woods, know, with the moss and everything else, and you can't see but 10, 15 feet into the woods. I mean, there could easily be an 8 foot to 10 foot tall humanoid standing there watching cars drive by, and you would never notice them. Absolutely.
Now, one final question before we bring Tobe on to bring his part of the equation in, before we talk full on about the film. Have you ever had your own experience with a Bigfoot, Brett? And if not, are you a believer or are you a researcher?
So I'm a filmmaker. I'm kind of becoming a researcher.
Okay.
I'm 100% believer. I would bet my life on the existence of Bigfoot, 100%, all day long. And that's not because I have had a direct visual experience per se, but I have had some experiences I can't explain. And, you know, one of those is some noises that I heard in the Owl Moon Wilderness, which is an area that Tobe is going to talk about, a very, very active spot Tobe has talked about. And, you know, many people that we've interviewed in our film have had actual sightings there. In fact, Daryl Adams may have a photo of a humanoid in that area. So, but I've had weird sounds. You know, I was doing some tree knocks in that area once and I wasn't getting any response. And then, you know, I kind of got a little frustrated. And so I did one, you know, with all my might, whack on the tree. And I got a response back about 10 seconds later that was 10 times as loud. And it almost sounded like a gunshot, but you can tell. It's like a cross between a gunshot and a baseball bat breaking. You knew it was wood. And when I heard that, I from head to toe, shivers went straight up. So that to me was confirmation that somebody was going, "Hey, knock it off. We're here. We don't want to talk."
Yeah.
So there's been a bunch of kind of odd experiences, you know, that have kind of helped confirm that. Yeah, they're out there and they're aware of us in the woods.
Interesting. And I've seen the trailer. I have not had a chance to see the whole movie yet, but I have gone through and purchased the movie, and it is on my list to watch as soon as we are done today. And with that being said, let's go ahead and bring up Tobe real quick. and chat with him. Tobe, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much. Let's get into real quick your history, because you were actually an author, have written The Owl Moon Lab, a paranormal experiment from the Bigfoot Chronicles series. And how is it that you came into the world of Sasquatch? How is it that you came into the world of writing about this?
Well, the writing part just recently came. It was all building up since the mid-2000s. And like Brett was saying earlier, without Spielberg's Close Encounter of the Third Kind and the character Richard Dreyfuss plays, Roy Neary, I don't know how many of these mysteries I would have looked into, because it was at the behest of watching that movie that the rest of the, you know, the curiosity was set into play. And that character is so well written, and it's so true. And, you know, over the years, I've found a lot of parallels between me and Roy Neary's character, and the way he just gets sucked into this world based upon, well, he had actually a pretty incredible encounter in the movie. But it doesn't take an incredible encounter. In the case for me and my son, it took a size 14-inch barefooted single track in the icy mud in the little town of Thurston, Oregon. And that set my imagination and my son's imagination on fire. And we became little Squatch monsters, you know, overnight.
Oh, wow.
And started to pursue conferences and looking out how to put on conferences. And, you know, it is and still is an immersive experience. And you get to know a lot about the phenomena really quick, because when people have encounters, that's all they want to do is retell their story.
Yeah.
And so I put together a venue in the little town of Leeburg, Oregon. And it was a monthly live event for people to have Bigfoot stories and beer and sit back in a pizza restaurant at O Dark 30 on a Wednesday night and tell Sasquatch stories.
That's awesome.
And so that led to, you know, talking to witnesses all the time, having them call me, email me, and then inviting me out to their property. And it's that part of the story where things really start to change, because of this classification of the type of witnesses. You have people that have benign, quick encounters, roadside crossings, for example. And then you have these other habituators or extended experiencers who literally have Sasquatch in their own backyard. That's their claim. And so they see them quite regularly.
Yeah.
And that's when Brett introduced himself to me, along with his wife, Jill, who's the producer, and said, "Hey, I hear you look into this. I hear you might have your own activity out in the little town of Cottage Grove. We'd like to meet." And so that's how we met.
Wow. Wow. And what an organic story. Like we were just talking about with Brett, the support in communities like this is what is so absolutely necessary. The fact that you actively built a place for people to come without judgment and unabridgedly share their experience and share their stories with other experiencers. That is an amazing and beautiful thing, Tobe. Is that meetup still going on?
Well, there was an iteration of it at Manresa Castle, a haunted castle in Port Townsend, Washington, until COVID hit. And now things are, you know, being reshaped because of this documentary took a huge priority. The book took a priority. But it needs to still be out there. If it's not me doing it, someone needs to do these live events where it doesn't even have to be Sasquatch, a place where people can come and meet, not online, in person, because that organic experience of hanging out and having a cold one with another experiencer can't be duplicated over Zoom or Skype.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, prime example, I was just at the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Conference and going to the Falk Monster Festival and going to see a lot of the same people. But to see the community of people that come together and that know each other and that are like family, It reminds me a lot personally of Comic-Cons, things like that. Even one of the guys that I interviewed at that road show who makes like custom figurines, things like that, out of horror characters, that kind of stuff. And he had like a Sasquatch for sale and all kinds of stuff. Really cool. Because he was into that community in Houston, we knew probably about a dozen of the same people within the comic book and Comic-Con community. And it really is that open atmosphere, like you said, of being able to share, being amongst people of like mind, where the experience truly comes to life.
Well, and just to bounce that point off, it really is a type of foreign war that they've all been involved with. It's like the old Legion meetup halls. The veterans of foreign wars are going to one of these lodges, and you have this secret handshake that develops. And it really is. I mean, you felt it this week, Brett. So did I.
Yeah.
And now you're one of us, you poor son of a gun.
That's all good.
One of us. And with that being said, how did your experience change you? Because, of course, it steeled you in a way and took you down the rabbit hole that has brought you to here. But how has it changed you as a person?
Well, it shifts your priorities in such a way because these, you know, as one of the witnesses says, Rich Germeau here out of Port Townsend, Washington, these things should not exist. And you're looking at something that the rest of the world says is not possible. So therefore, now your priorities have shifted because you've taken the red pill and you've left behind this lie. And it's much, you know, it's tantamount to having a conversion experience. And so when you take that risk of going down that rabbit hole and pursuing what this other world is, you have to leave other things behind. And, you know, that can be tragic in some sense, because that could be family, that could be job, that could be other perceived priorities. And so I've noticed in, you know, my case, my priorities are totally different. I'm an artist now, as you know. I was a truck driver when all this happened. And so, you know, I live up here and money's not a problem because I don't worry about it as much, you know. And also you don't sweat the small stuff in general. That's something I've noted for myself. I don't know about you, Brett, but things take on a whole new meaning because they seem temporal. This mystery is so prolonged and so deep that I think it comes long after you're gone. You know, maybe we'll find out the answers more. I know we will. But there's something about this phenomena that has to do with how the Native Americans appreciated time as a circle instead of a linear line. And that's hard for us to understand in our culture. But once you lean in that direction, it changes who you hang out with.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, like you said, the whole paradigm with which you think. We talk about that regularly on this show, the fact that we as humans gave time its boundary and its definition. So we are prone to think of it within that scope when it may not necessarily be so. And it really does do us a disservice to do so, because typically it can lead to the fact that you are coming to the table with a preconceived notion instead of an open scientific mind. And I think that is probably the most important thing. Now, before we go to commercial real quick, Tobe, one final question for you. Before your experience with your son and finding this footprint, were you a believer? Were you someone who, growing up in the area, much like Brett, had heard about these things? It was kind of pervasive in the local culture. And were you someone who believed in the presence of Sasquatch, or someone that was kind of right. like, ah, probably not?
I don't know. I have a buddy, Tim Renner, who does Strange Familiars, and he wrote a little bit about the Owl Moon Lab. And he said, you know, you and I probably suffer from the same disease. And I said, what's that, Tim? He goes, believe it, itis. And I said, yeah, yeah. I probably do have that. Because I so much love a good mystery. Beyond my believe it itis is also the actuality of the data, you know, the forensic data that is available, from hair to footprints to FLIR to, you know, even going back to 67, yet once again with the Patterson-Gimlin film. Yeah. Your willingness to not look at the data, you know, puts you in the guilt box, as far as I'm concerned. If you do not look at that data, then you're guilty of ignoring it. You know, that omission is a lie.
Yes.
And so it's the same with the UFO stuff. I mean, you can't talk about Sasquatch without talking about what's going on with UFOs. It's totally linked. And one day we'll have our own Congress panel. It's just not time yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And we will get into that and so much more here in just a second. Please do hold the line, gentlemen, while we break for commercial. We will be back in just 1 second after these messages, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7%. Off your entire purchase of $50 or more, and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com, and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is podcastcadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. And we are back. Thank you so much to our sponsors once again. As always, without you guys, this show cannot happen, especially WebWorks Wireless out there providing all of our amazing live streams to our websites, as well as live streams out on location. Welcome back, Brett and Tobe. Now, we had a chance in the first part of the show to really get to know you guys, get to understand where you came from in the making of A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed, this new documentary out from Resonance Productions, available now on most streaming platforms, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Amazon, iTunes, Vudu, Google Play. You can rent it on YouTube if you want. We don't, at this point, we don't have any physical DVDs or Blu-rays that we are selling, but that
is okay.
Potentially change.
Well, yeah. And you know, even I myself, I tell people all the time, like when I go to the conferences, I buy all the authors' books, and they're like, "Whoa, are you serious?" And I'm like, "I would be buying them anyway if you were a guest on my show." Mm-hmm. So that's how I support. Your DVDs, keep the DVDs. I'll make sure to buy them digitally. I'm just a recyclable kind of guy in that aspect. Like the actual just pallets of DVDs, it always reminds me of like the back alley scene from Back to the Future 2, where they like lay her on the pallets of laser discs, and it's like, yep, that's right where we're at. there's just pallets of broken CDs and DVDs everywhere. When we made a digital file to begin with, you know, like we're in the day and age now where you can watch a pretty good movie on your phone, folks. So
yeah,
feel free to just buy a digital copy. Not that a CD or DVD isn't great. But yeah, I'm a big digital guy when it comes to that. So good for you guys on getting it out there on all platforms. Now, before we went to break, we were talking with Tobe about the rabbit hole. Where this leads in your life. And now, Tobe, you were saying that you yourself went down the hard rabbit hole of the experiencer. And Brett, you were coming at the rabbit hole from the rabbit hole of a filmmaker and a researcher. Now, at what point did you guys meet and start fleshing out A Flash of Beauty?
So we met pretty early on in the process, and when we started doing our first initial interviews, we did it at a little tiny conference called Beachfoot, which is down in kind of near the central coast of Oregon. And Jill and I had just been kind of devouring Bigfoot documentaries and paranormal documentaries to that point to kind of like figure out what was out there and what wasn't out there, and some of the techniques that were being done from a story perspective, and, you know, how productions were executed with, you know, what kind of cameras, so on and so forth. And so We went into this conference and we were interviewing some folks there. You know, Todd Neitz was one of the individuals we interviewed. And this guy, Daryl Adams, shows up. And we had just seen Daryl in this film, The Alien Bigfoot Connection. And we knew that we had made a decision that we needed and wanted to get a hold of Daryl and Tobe and talk to them, because we were really moved by their story and some of the evidence that they were showing. And of course, you know, Cottage Grove is, you know, 2 hours from us. They're close. And so Daryl showed up, we got to talking to him, and one thing led to another, and Tobe and I first talked about 3 or 4 days later. And then it just went from there. You know, we came down to Cottage Grove, I think in July of 2020, and did the first interview in the back of a, they were sitting in the back of a pickup truck. And we left that knowing that this was going to be quite the adventure with these two guys.
Now, with that being said, at what point did you already have, between the two of you, a plan of approach with the film? Was it a fact that as things went along, focus has changed? Was there a point from an experience or someone that led you down a further different rabbit hole during the production of this?
So I think that going into this, we approached this a little bit differently than we would a traditional film. So initially, it was just Jill, myself, and Mike Ferry, the cinematographer. And once we got a chance to really get to know Tobe, Daryl, and, you know, we were making multiple trips down to the Owl Moon Lab. And it was at that point that we realized that Tobe was going to be a huge asset from the production side of things as a producer on the film. And we started asking a lot of questions, and Tobe started making a lot of connections. And one thing led to another. And what's really cool about this film, and what I really love about this film, is it came together entirely 100% organically. We were just kind of led down a path, if you will. And that is a technique. That is a way that you can make a documentary, is you can kind of just go out and just shoot and shoot and shoot, and then find out what the story is in the editing room. And we knew what we wanted to say. There was some very important things that we wanted to say. And so we kept that at the forefront and crafted our questions in that manner, and made a decision to film the interviews direct to camera, so the audience would feel like they were being a part of the conversation. Mm. So those are some definite things that we decided to do. But otherwise, we felt it out. We wanted to just be there with cameras to see what would unwind and what would develop in front of the cameras.
Wow. And like you said, very, very organic in style. And with that in mind, at what point did you guys start exploring the different facets of Bigfoot? Because as you mentioned a while ago, Tobe, there is, especially once you get into, as opposed to, let's say, the UFO UAP community, even the psychic remote viewing community, things like that, astral projection community, there's a difference in the Sasquatch community when it comes to, and almost a bitter difference when it comes to Sasquatch and UFOs together, or Sasquatch and paranormal events together. But it's interesting how many sightings and how many stories take place around sightings and paranormal events.
Right. Well, I'll take a step back from that comment for a second.
Sure.
Because it starts with...
It's a firecracker comment to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, it starts with the impossibility of there being multiple sightings from single witnesses. That's where it starts for me.
Sure.
Circa 2009, with a river guide who said, I have multiple experiences. They come to my house and, you know, strange stuff happens around them. And that story kept happening with these habituators, these extended experiencers. And they would have these multiple sightings, usually on or around their acreage. Now, you can also have these sightings in hot spots like Bluff Creek, where you can have multiple sightings of a clan group or a pod or whatever we're going to call these neighborhoods. And you go into Bigfoot neighborhood and you sit in a hot spot during a certain time of year or whenever. And you can have an experience with a certain individual or a certain clan member or leader of the group. So I would hear these stories. I'd show up at these pizza parlors and say as much. Not always. Traditionally, it was, you know, people that were very reluctant to tell me these things because having a sighting of Bigfoot is crazy enough. But when you start saying, oh, no, they are around and they watch my children sitting Indian style, you know, from the bottom deck. These are things that people tell you with, you know, waterworks going on and twitching lips and nervous hands. And, you know, once you have an experience on their property with them, of course, they feel vindicated. But now you've got a problem because now you've become one of them. And that just kept happening to me.
Wow.
And I couldn't deny it. You know, they were just it was far too often.
And, you know, it's one of those. Even hosting the incarnation of this show before this, we deal with a lot of targeted individuals, a lot of experiencers of paranormal, things like that. And people ask me frequently, like, do you believe their story? I myself have had my own experiences that, like, I cannot explain. And even within communities, like, hey, I went to serve in the seminary because of my experience. And imagine my surprise when I got there and shared my story. And there were a bunch of pie-eyed people that were like, oh, really? Well, okay. You know, you think you just walked into the Pizza Hut full of people, but not really. and that's why I share them. And that's why I choose to believe anybody's experience until proven otherwise. Like you said, I am all about evidence, everything else. Let's gather all that we can. But I am prone to believe the experiencer until the experience can be disproven.
I mean, this is a part of our human history that we're denying.
Oh, absolutely.
We have to write this down properly. We have to keep track of these stories. And, you know, Brett and Jill were offering all of us in the dock a way to do it that was not only beautiful, but it led the charge to say, this is so profound, it changes everything. We need to talk to these witnesses, though they are almost patients. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a total clinical sense, but they've been through a lot, even if it's a brief sighting. They've been traumatized by having the worldview completely shattered, not necessarily from a frightening experience, but from the fact that the world is flat and, you know, that kind of theory, right? That something is totally different.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, with that in mind, Brett, did it become at any point, I guess, incumbent on y'all to document things from, like, local tribal leaders, anything like that? Did y'all have a chance to document any of their traditional stories, things like that? Because, as Tobe's saying, this is, of course, a large part of our unwritten human history.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, Chris. We felt like it was very important to start off the documentary with the Native perspective and some of the Native history. And
awesome.
That's and that's a topic that deserves its own series of documentaries, the human history. But we wanted to showcase the Native history, the Native cultures. We focused on the Pacific Northwest. But, I just want to acknowledge the fact that so many tribes and cultures ourselves, we've been out to Rez Squatching in Nebraska, so many cultures across this country and Canada and the United States have a history. and we're talking about, you know, all four corners of the lower 48 and Alaska.
Yeah.
And so I want to acknowledge that fact, but we only really had time to get into the Pacific Northwest tribes of British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington.
Sure.
And we also wanted to showcase some of the history of the white settlers and what they heard from the natives. And so we get into that a little bit too. But yeah, that's a huge, huge component. And it's, I don't think it's something that we knew a lot about going into it. And, you know, being raised in the Pacific Northwest, I always kind of thought it was just part of the folklore of the tribes. But what I found out was it is actually part of the culture in these are relationships.
Yep.
That they've had for, you know, thousands of years with this other quote unquote tribe in the forest.
Yeah, absolutely. To the point where they have trade with them.
Yeah.
It is incredible. And once again, I'm more prone to believe their tradition being an unbroken oral tradition than whatever we have written down.
Agreed.
That's just me for the fact of, yeah, they have taken the care to preserve these histories the way that they have. And you really do have to wonder, especially whenever these histories are transcribed, that kind of stuff, what is removed, what is taken out. The example I make all the time is Beowulf. Great story. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Vikings did not write their stories down. That was written down by Christian missionaries. So who knows what they changed to befit the telling of the story beyond the borders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what we have to ask ourselves. And kudos to you guys for digging as deep as you could and getting into, yeah, the actual history of the local cultures. Not just the myth, not just the folklore, but the spoken word history that they have about it.
Yeah. And it's also important for, you know, I think there's a lot of people that think, you know, in the general public that aren't familiar with, you know, Bigfoot other than the Patterson-Gimlin film, that kind of think that that's where Bigfoot originated. It was a hoax. It was a guy in a suit and it was a hoax. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, and Bigfoot over a period of time has kind of become a joke to a certain extent to certain people, because it's to them it just seems so outlandish, you know. It originated with a guy and some poorly made feet that wanted to freak out his construction buddies, you know, on a job site in Northern California. And now here we are, you know. So it's important to lay that groundwork.
Yeah.
That historical groundwork.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the topics that we talk about regularly on this show is crop circles and the fact of, yes, a great number of crop circles that you see in the modern age are hoaxes. They are hoaxable. The 10 to 20% that are not need great investigation. And you have to remember that the story of these, quote, devil circles go back to the 1500s. But to the time of wood carvings, and where there are wood carvings and stories about them right up along the Black Plague. So, you know what people didn't have time to do in the Black Plague? Like, go out and destroy half a field of wheat for a hoax.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, what about all those accounts? What about the accounts into the 1600s, things like that? And like you said, let's get into real quick a couple of the things that you guys found out about the expanding white exploration into the Northwest and what they were told by the locals.
So we talked a little bit about an artist by the name of Paul Kane who came out to, well, not very far from where I'm standing right now, about 15 miles is crow flies near St. Helens, modern day St. Helens, Oregon. And he found a band of natives and he wanted them to take him up to Mount St. Helens so he could paint it. And this, of course, was before Mount St. Helens blew its top.
Sure.
And, you know, before Mount St. Helens erupted, it was probably the most beautiful mountain in the Cascade Range. And so he wanted to go up there, and they were like, nope. You know, he offered him money, the whole nine yards. And I said, nope, they're cannibals up there. They're these huge, hairy beasts. And this is an account from 1840s, 1850s.
Oh, wow.
And they describe them to a T. You know, they describe the modern day. It sounds like a modern day Sasquatch story. You know, another account is from a missionary who Mr. Walker. Why his name is escaping me right now. E. Walker. He was a missionary out in Eastern Washington, and the same thing. You know, he wrote a letter back to a pastor of a church in Boston, was telling him the stories about how the natives were saying, don't go into the mountains because, you know, there's these beasts that'll come and kidnap you in the middle of the night. And then you wake up confused and dazed. And he even describes the size of their foot in this letter. And again, this is a letter that was written in, I think, the 1860s or 1870s. So, you know, those historical accounts are detailed. They're accurate to what people are reporting today. It really makes you think.
Yeah, especially whenever, like you said, the description of it hadn't really changed. I don't know how many people are going through and reading documentation from the 1800s just to, once again, go through and fake something or be ridiculed. Of course, there are regular hoaxers out there, and sadly, yes, the Sasquatch community is probably within the greater realm of that. Whenever you talk footprints, hair samples, there was, of course, the famous guy a few years ago, many, many years ago now, who claimed to have the Bigfoot in his freezer, who has come out and said, like, yes, it was a hoax, and I'm so sorry. Like, it totally ruined my life. and that's an example of the hoaxing gone awry, ruining his life, you know?
Yeah.
And he was treated as though it was real for a long time, and even that can ruin your life once again.
Yeah.
So
there's no question.
During the filming of this, did you guys come across anybody who whose life was drastically changed in that way after their experience?
Everybody. I'm trying to think of somebody whose life wasn't changed dramatically by a sighting, and there isn't a single person that we talked to who didn't have a complete and total paradigm shift. And you could go so far as to say that some individuals have questioned everything there is to question about existence itself. You know, which isn't a great place to be in, because you kind of feel like everything and anything could be potentially betraying you or hoaxing you, because you feel like you've been lied to your entire life.
Sure.
But no, I don't know that there's anybody that we've talked to that didn't have a profound experience, so much so that you know, it was traumatic for them. Some people it wasn't traumatic, other people it certainly was traumatic, especially the folks that were by themselves when it happened. So yeah, it definitely is a revolution.
And just to expand on that too, as you're watching this film, you'll see new faces, and one of the faces that pops up is this psychologist and hypnotherapist, and they talk about what happens with traumatic based memories and where they get filed, and how you can bury them in certain ways, basically for safety's sake. So,
oh, absolutely.
That can't help but shift and change your life because of what's happened to trauma-based memories. So, you know, working with these people inadvertently, in some cases, doing conferences with them, and now having them as friends and family. There are most of them, I would say a good 85% of them are completely changed in some way or another. They look at other details or conspiracies altogether differently, that's for sure. But there is a subsect of people that they just kind of play off their experience as something that happened and it was an animal and that's it. And just like, well, you know, I'll just keep my head on a swivel in that area. And I was always fascinated by those types of people because I'm just not. And very few of the people that look into this really are. But there's a small subset of people. But what would you do then with them on camera? You know, they don't really have a story beyond that. It hasn't changed them. And this is a transformational narrative of what happens to the witness.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. And, you know, once again, the fact that, like you said, very much a conversion experience for some people. And yet still a traumatic enough experience. Like, for instance, with our friend Terry, he and his friend who he experienced this with never talked about it ever. And Terry Lovelace and his friend who he was with, like, they were paramedic drivers together. That's like being out on the beat as cops. Like, you do everything together. You know, you're like tight, best of friends. So the fact that after their experience, they were both so traumatized and so awestruck that they never spoke about it with each other. It was never a topic of conversation. They both compartmentalized it so hard.
That's common.
And it ended up literally driving a wedge in between their friendship. They never saw each other again. All kinds of stuff. These things didn't come to Terry until years later, you know? And the brain is fantastic at compartmentalizing things like that, at being able to lock that away. Now, during the filming of this, because, of course, I mean, I've even had it where I have triggered people in conversation just by the conversation that we are having. About the topic and bringing about things that they had totally forgotten about. Did y'all have any experiences like that while y'all were recording this documentary?
I don't know that we had, we certainly had some people get emotional. Sure. I don't know that we had anybody that, you know, specifically told us to turn off the camera or they couldn't go through this anymore. There were individuals that we wanted to get on camera. You know, for instance, there was a scientist that we were really wanting to get on camera who had a sighting with five of his brothers, actually, in the Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, I think it is. And this is back the day after Thanksgiving in 1981 or 82, and they were out hunting, and he saw a Sasquatch cutting through the forest, carrying a bull elk underneath his right arm.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, anybody who knows the size of a bull elk, especially us that live in the Pacific Northwest, knows that that would leave a scar in your brain.
That's a big critter.
That's a big critter. And he was telling us this story over Zoom, and his eyes were watering, and his lip was quivering. And he looked right into the camera and he pointed at Jill and I and he said, "You don't want to see one. You don't want to see one."
Wow.
It affected us.
And
but he wouldn't go on camera. So,
and I can imagine that. I can imagine that from the frame of reference that I have of my very, very, like, within a foot and a half encounter of a female moose. Where I was just sitting in this little building out on a golf shack, out in a golf course, and heard something and looked over, and there was literally a female moose's head inside of the window right next to me. And yeah, it's one of those, like, you see a moose and you know they're big, but until you see their face like a foot away from yours, you really don't realize how big they are and how much you do not want to mess with a moose. And yeah, that was a frighteningly still moment in my life. Even as someone who's hunted his whole life, stuff like that, where it was like, I cannot move right now. Like, I was literally frozen in fear from knowing that, like, if I panicked or even moved, that thing would destroy me right now. just by its sheer size. So
yeah.
to imagine that, especially with something that you're just coming to realize what it is, or that it's real, or that it's there, I could utterly see that being the experience at hand.
Yeah, and I think psychologically, something that's shaped like a human being is worse, because, you know, I've been 150, 200 feet away from a grizzly bear. And I got out of my car to get some pictures of it, and I felt like I was in a safe place. And of course, I left the door open. You know, I was like ready to jump in at any given moment, but that was scary. But at the same time, I knew it was a bear. I could equate it with a bear. And seeing something that's 8-9 feet tall, maybe taller, that looks like a human being, I think really gets into the psyche.
Yeah.
As strange as that sounds, because it's like you have to try and, you know, you're trying to rationalize what this thing is, and you immediately know that this is, it's a type of person, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, gorillas, yeah, sure, they have humanoid qualities, but a gorilla moves like a gorilla.
Mm.
Or a chimpanzee moves like a chimpanzee. Bigfoot move like an athlete, like Shaquille O'Neal, like a massive human being. So I think that's what really gets into people. It's, you know, we talk, Dr. Michael Adams in our documentary talks about how an image is seared into your brain, you know, and these people, it's almost like that iconic Sasquatch image we see everywhere. It's like, these people in the middle of the night, every time they close their eyes at days and weeks after their sighting, that's what they're seeing. They're seeing this huge humanoid figure.
Now, with that in mind, I want to kind of rewind a few minutes back to where we were talking about the paranormal and Sasquatch, especially with that humanoid figure, things like that. Were you guys privy to any stories of Bigfoot and portals, Bigfoot and other creatures being with him? Anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take that one, Brett, if you don't mind. And let's just go a little bit softer with the angle to talk about how strange all this is. And then we'll lean on what we were just talking about, how the witness sees a Sasquatch and it looks so human. We tried to get a lot of different people in this documentary that would change things. One of these guys was ex-Deputy Sheriff Jeff Boiler out of Three Sisters. Our sisters, Oregon. And Jeff, back in the 80s, was hiking the South Sister and thought he saw an elk in rut on the side of a ledge while he was hiking in the backcountry. And as he diverted his attention and then concentrated on the image, it was still there, only now it was looking at him and it had shoulders and a head. Now, Jeff was, you know, an off-duty cop, and but still blown away by what he was seeing. He could not profile this except to say that elk turned into a caveman, you know, and his mind is just looking like an archaic caveman. And so Jeff drops his, you know, mouth to the floor or the ground in amazement at what he's looking at. And this individual, we'll call him, also dropped his mouth to the floor. And as Jeff turned his head to the left in amazement at this thing copying him, this thing turned its head to the, you know, left or right and copied the same movement. Now, Jeff retold this story on television one time a little bit, but in private, he told me that as a cop, he could tell that this Sasquatch, which is what it was not mimicking him. It was mocking him. It was making fun of the fact that I've been here the whole time.
Oh, wow.
You're cocking your head like, you know, this is some big deal to you. I could outgun you, snap you in half. And it was at that moment that, you know, in that snap second as a cop, that Jeff thought about grabbing his gun. And at that thought of grabbing that gun, this thing bolted. It wasn't that Jeff motioned. It was him thinking, oh, my God, this is a human.
Wow.
And he had his sidearm, you know, in his pack. And the fact that this thing left when he thought about grabbing his gun, and then, you know, the rest of the episode you can see on Paranormal Witness, but it pursued him just out of distance of sight, and chased him by breaking trees along the way back to his car.
Wow.
And incredible encounter story. So these are the kind of stories that most flesh and blood people have along the way. They would agree that they're hyper-intelligent. They would agree that they're human-like. They've gone since the mid-2000s using language of it being a missing link to now the fancy term relic hominid, which puts them in the human category now. They've sure. gone from, you know, giant, you know, dirt monkey to this archaic human that basically is rich as calling them an undocumented human running around in our woods.
Yeah.
So, but it does get much more stranger in the documentary, and certainly in the next chapter that Brett's filming, the story of the Owl Moon, you know, I'm hinting at it in part one, that things are going to take a turn for the strange, and I'm prepared for it. The witness is gearing up to be, you know, prepared for this moment of strangeness. And it doesn't take other entities or portals for it to implicate how strange it is. That those sudden moves, the Jeff Boiler story I just yeah. told you, tells us that we're dealing with something altogether different. It can predict movement, and it can disturb you in such a way with its humanity at the same time that what are we dealing with?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, whenever you're talking about relic hominid, things like that, you know, God, we discovered over 500 species last year.
Wow.
That was during a pandemic. The average is closer to 1,000 or so a year that are found. And when you're talking about things like Dragon Man just being confirmed in China, where, yeah, that was an actual skull that was thrown down a well. That, yep, actual confirmed species of man where, you know, they are about 7 to 9 feet tall and have a brain capacity far beyond that of typical human. The hobbits that were found just a few years ago, they are actively wondering whether or not they may still exist.
Mm-hmm.
So, which of course would go straight up to the stories of the locals saying that, yeah, they exist. So it's odd for me, once again, for people who discredit, anything that is out there, but what kind of evidence did you guys come across during the filming of this?
Well, you know, one of the strong pieces of evidence that kind of sticks out in my mind is a case that Diane Stocking Niece investigated right around 2000, 2001, I think it was, down in Brevard County, Florida. And there was a woman at a wastewater treatment plant who was working the night shift, and she looked over and there was a Sasquatch with its, or a skunk ape, I guess, if you will, with its arms leaning up against the window, face pressed against the window, watching the Windows 95 thing bouncing around on the computer, which is kind of a cool image, right? You know, I mean, here's some of this humanity that we're kind of thinking of when, you know, we kind of think of this cute Sasquatch looking in going, huh, what's that? And Diane was able to get some really good photos, and she got some prints of this kind of oily substance that this thing left on the windows, which has been true of many, many cases.
Oh, wow.
Of these things touching glass or metal or whatever. And Tobe can talk about that a little bit more, too, because he's encountered it as well. But she got great photos. She got a great eyewitness account. And that's not something I think has been publicized much in the Bigfoot community. So we went down there and we got some drone footage of the wastewater treatment plant. You can kind of see how this might have happened. I mean, this area is surrounded by swampland and, you know, heavy kind of forested, quasi-forested area. And even much more so when it happened 20 years ago. There's actually been a bit of development since then. So that's a case that sticks out. And you know, we do have something at the end of the film that will be a little bit controversial, and I don't want to get into it right now too much, but what I can say is we have some photographs from a sighting up in Western Alaska. This is a father-daughter sighting, but it took place separately with 2 years in between. That particular sighting, you know, Daryl is his name, who actually had the first sighting, to me is one of the strongest sightings I've ever heard. And that was, it was a sighting that occurred over the period of 10, 20 minutes, quite a long time, you know, with his son-in-law from a boat, on the Andreski River, looking out, you know, they were just watching this thing trading binoculars back and forth. And then a couple of years ago, Daryl's daughter, Rachel, got a couple of photographs of one on the tundra. So, you know, like anything else, you know, I think there's people are going to look at the photos and wonder if they're real or not. And we address that in the film. But I think that's going to be something that, you know, it already has raised a lot of eyebrows and a lot of questions, which is fun. I think, you know, it's fun. It's a mystery that all of us amateur sleuths can kind of, you know, ourselves included, can try and solve.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And the main thing is being willing to explore the options. And if it turns out to be nothing, or it turns out to be something else, so be it. The main thing is being willing to question and having the open mind. Because I think that it, once again, bringing up just the hobbits, Dragon Man, 500 species discovered when nobody was out roaming the world, really. It's odd for me to hear scientists say that we have already explored and it is not. That to me is a little strange to hear, and a little more than disheartening for the field of science, I would say. Now, as far as your personal beliefs, have they been changed after making this documentary, or have they been strengthened?
Strengthened. Definitely strengthened. I speak on behalf of myself and Jill to say that we both believe 100%. 100% that these things are real. And I would say 99.9% that they have paranormal abilities.
Wow.
Maybe even 100%.
Wow.
It's just, we've just, you know, having an opportunity to sit and talk with somebody, firsthand witness.
Yeah.
And to go all, you know, we went all over the country and met with these people. And what, you know, what often kind of gives us advantages of, you know, being filmmakers is a lot of people will tell us the story, which is astounding. And then when we turn the camera off, we start getting more and more details, you know, like, oh, I forgot about this. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
By this time we're packed up and ready to go. But we will always get some extra tidbits or some extra details. And it's unfortunate we can't always put that in the film, but but it just goes, it kind of just solidifies these stories and these ideas. I mean, there's we're open minded to the idea and the fact that there's some people may be recollecting it differently than the way it happened, there's always the potential for it being something different, or maybe they're exaggerating. But you know, for the most part, I can't think of anybody that's in our film that exaggerated anything, stretched the truth. I think everybody was very forthright and honest with us. And I believe that, you know, a lot of people say, well, I believe they saw something. Yeah, I believe they saw something, and that something was a Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Or a Bigfoot.
Yeah. And what do you think it will take? I would like this answer from both of you guys individually, I guess Tobe first, followed by Brett. But Scientifically, just given what you have seen, given any evidence out there as we know it, what do you think it will take for science to accept or at least study further? Now, granted, I talk with quite a few researchers, things like that, and it's interesting to see how many of them team up with like their local Parks and Wildlife Service, things like that, and will actually become a part of their grant. Mm-hmm. Because they're out like setting up trail cams, and all that is more data for parks and wildlife. So mm-hmm. great cooperation's going on between these communities and, you know, founded places. And once again, Oregon being one of the only places where you can see, you know, Sasquatch protected signs up in parks. But what do you think it will take for science to explore this topic more?
Well, you almost want to say it would take the Bigfoot's will to have humanity to do it. And I know that sounds pretty crazy, but they seem to call the shots so many, you know, so many times, so many examples of this. But as we were saying before, you know, we were talking about this over the weekend, is that it's not in the government's best interest to talk about this. And they certainly don't interview researchers because, as our buddy Rich Germo was saying, they already have these answers. Yeah. They don't need any information. They don't need any data. They don't need our tracks. They don't need our hair. They don't need our greasy fingerprints to be given to them. You know, very rarely do you hear about the intimidation tactic of the men in black showing up at the door of a Bigfoot witness that usually goes into the UFO camp. Mm. I've heard about the Department of Interior being interested in this. I've had interesting stuff happen to me that makes me wonder what's going on. In fact, we were just talking about some of the stuff that happens when I leave the house. And this goes a little bit into the physical world, but conspiratorial nonetheless, is that, you know, the Department of Interior may knock at a witness's door and have an intimidating conversation with somebody that says, hey, don't talk about this anymore.
Sure.
And it's usually one big, you know, buff dude that looks like he's straight out of the MMA and a little brainiac dude. And they flash their badge and they do their business and, you know, they make get their point across. But I've had interesting stuff happen here that makes me wonder. We were just talking about coming home from the woods. We live in a cabin in the woods. Okay. And we have two pugs, so we have to leave the door slightly ajar when we go on hikes or have a dog sitter. And when we came back, sitting square on the kitchen table was a thumb drive. It was a bright orange rubber thumb drive.
Oh.
And it was sitting square in the middle of the dining room table. And nobody would account for the thumb drive. But it had me thinking, and maybe that's my paranoid mind, is that maybe I've uncovered something too deep, and this is some kind of, you know, manila envelope, a digital version of that with encoded information. And, you know, my friends are not too responsible, I guess. They would push me down that rabbit hole. However, how crazy of that thing, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to do.
I wouldn't plug it into my computer, like Jack. I'll tell you that right now. If I came home and it's like, well, I don't own an orange thumb drive. How about you, honey?
Yeah.
Nope. Well, we live in a cabin.
Yeah.
Like, even if there's nothing on it, who knows what worm it just put into your system, you know? Like, that's
wish I was as smart as you.
Oh, no. What was on it?
Well, no, I did. I stupidly put it in my computer I'm on with you now.
Oh.
And, you know, it had no data on it as far as I could tell. It had like an empty folder, an empty file. Mm. But maybe I uploaded something on my computer. So, you know, I didn't know that was even possible.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, getting to the point, it's just like they may have an interest in stopping you from doing something, but I don't think they want to share information with you and get this out here. It's, you know, as long as these programs go on in perpetuity, there is a financial aspect to this.
Sure.
Even for these contractors, as long as it just keeps rolling in and takes forever, they can keep getting funding. So why solve it?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Brett, how about you? What do you think it would take for science to take a good hard look at Sasquatch? Well,
in my opinion, we don't need a body. As crazy as that sounds, I know every scientist would argue with me, but you know, we haven't brought rocks back from Mars. We haven't brought any gases back from Jupiter.
Yeah.
You know, we have so many things in science that we don't question that that mankind has never visited and or seen or sampled or whatnot. What I think is eventually technology is going to out the Sasquatch, and in some ways it already has. What is so neat to me as somebody who is kind of a techno nerd, if you will, is seeing what's happening in recent times with the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Sure.
And, you know, people say that these things are extremely careful to avoid cameras, and that's true. And I believe that they are picking up with the frequency, the electromagnetic frequency, or something that they can hear and or they can sense. And this is true with a lot of animals. So I believe they have that ability. I believe that they have some sort of understanding of the fact that cameras can capture them. Patty, on the other hand, didn't seem to care. Didn't have any sort of notion as to what was happening. Yeah. And what's so cool about that is they shot that on 16mm film. And, you know, a lot of people out there would think, oh, yeah, well, you know, high definition video and cell phone video today is better than that. And that was back in the 60s. And
nope.
16mm film is equivalent to HD.
That's right.
And
35mm has more than 4K in it as far as pixel resolution. So you want to talk about, right, like, what are they doing upgrading 35mm movies to 4K? It already has better than 4K resolution. Your projector just wasn't able to read all the pixels.
Yeah, and I think that people equate it with bad quality because they think of the dust and the scratches and stuff. But we can get rid of all that stuff.
Yes.
We can get rid of it now. We can stabilize it now. And with artificial intelligence, we can enhance it. And so in the documentary, a man by the name of Henry Franzoni, which some people might recognize his name, he's been in the Bigfoot community for a long time. He talks about how he was given a budget of $500,000 in the late 90s to analyze that film. And they got the best transfer ever made of it, and they went through it. And, you know, they're looking at, like, the dirt on Patty.
Mm.
And they're seeing the muscles underneath the skin. And I think that, you know, a lot of people could do themselves a service and really go back and look at some of the research that's been done on that film footage alone and see just how incredible that film is. And I can tell you as a filmmaker that costume in the 1960s would have been impossible manufactured to that spec.
Prime example would be, you know what won the Oscar in the, right up around the same time? Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm. Planet of the Apes.
That was the special effects level that we were at, folks.
Mm-hmm.
So for some dude out hiking in the middle of the woods to just have something like that yes, is showing like muscles move under the skin, showing muscle groups, things like that. That is a high level of sophistication.
Yeah, it's a high level of sophistication. The fact that it's a female is another thing to me that says that it's authentic because, you know, in as much as I hate to say this, but a couple of cowboys, a couple of, you know, good old cowboys are not going to go to the trouble to build a female Sasquatch. They just wouldn't do it. I think there would have been a little.
I think it's a point of detail that most hoaxers would not even think about.
So that's a great point. The other great point is that you have to have a performer. You have to have an actor.
Yeah.
And you have to have somebody who's good at theatrics and somebody who has studied the way that a chimp would walk or a gorilla would walk. And we're talking about somebody who's been really trained in movment and performance, how this thing moves. And that's rehearsal. That's getting used to the suit. That's getting comfortable in the suit. Nobody's ever talking about any of this kind of stuff. So, you know, we're looking at, if it is in fact a hoax, we're looking at a really good execution of a short film.
Absolutely.
With a trained actor, with Oscar caliber costume designers, and people that were willing to go clear out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this isn't off the side of the road.
Yeah.
Bluff Creek is way out in the middle of nowhere. I hope to go there this summer. So there's all of these different things that are pointing to this thing being 100% authentic, you know? So that's what I find ironic, is that it's like, we've had the proof now for 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's right in front of our face. And as technology gets better and better and better, that film is going to get better and better and better.
And it really is a case where every single time that they try to debunk it with modern technology, it just stands the ground. Yep. It really does. And it's very, very remarkable, because once again, shot in just moments. And it's a prime example. One of the things, like, I'm a trained cameraman. You can't see my cameras here probably. but like I've got like a G2 broadcast camera, all kinds of stuff, you know. I am trained in what I do, but whenever people are like, how come every time we see an image of a Sasquatch or an image of a UFO, it's blurry, or it's like, number one, I challenge you to get in focus that fast. Or even have the presence of mind to whip out a camera while you're experiencing it. Then not be adrenalized. Zoom in to try to catch it and not be shaky.
Yep.
The things that you see on NFL, stuff like that, that is a known quantitative. They know that the ball should be going to the right now. that's the action of play. Should be going from the left to the right. Because that team's got the ball. And they also have multi-million-dollar camera lenses that no matter how fast they zoom in or out, it's always in focus.
Yeah.
So that's not what the average person, like, hiking around is carrying with them. Even if you're out doing nature photography, anything like that, what you see out of a nature photographer's reel is one shot out of, like, 50.
Mm-hmm.
That they chose to show you where the bokeh's right and the subject's in focus, things like that. The other 80 shots that they took in quick burst to get that are poop.
Yeah.
They are utterly useless.
100%. But here's the interesting thing, Chris, is that there are clear photos out there.
Mm.
I mean, photos that would blow people away. Photos that are better than the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I've seen them. We just can't get permission to use them. And I think that that's a protective mechanism. I think people want to hold it close to their chest because, one, they don't want to be ridiculed, because somebody someplace is going to say it's fake regardless.
Oh, sure.
You know, in the world that we live in now, with cameras in our pockets, people are going to get these photos. And the photos that we feature in our film were taken close to 10 years ago. But Rachel was told by her husband not to post on social media because he didn't want the photos to affect his job. He was an Alaskan state trooper.
Yeah.
He didn't want to deal with the ridicule. He didn't want to trace back to him.
Yeah.
And she respected those wishes. But they've since separated, and she's the copyright holder on those photos. And so she agreed to let us feature them.
Amazing.
But they are out there. Those photos are out there. We've seen them. And... you know, it's just, I think when some of them start coming out, you know, and I'm talking about close-ups on heads.
Wow.
But when those individuals that have them decide to put them out there, they will be deconstructed and ridiculed.
And you know, that's just it. And I think, once again, like we said earlier, that is a lot of the reason why a lot of the evidence out there, be it photographic, video, hair, footprints, what have you, does not come to light, is fear of ridicule.
Yeah.
And not just ridicule, but what the hard scrutiny can do to your life to begin with.
Yeah, and I want to make real quick one more point about your question about when is science going to recognize it. And I think that that's one of the major hurdles that we need to get over, that scientists need to get over, is the ridicule. And, you know, I commend Dr. Meldrum and some of those other folks that are willing to go out there and say, hey, this is not just
absolutely hoaxers.
I mean, you know, we need, and we talk about this in the film, you know, Dr. Michael Adams, the psychologist, talks about how people need to just be pioneers. They just need to forge ahead and just block out all the noise.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us know, and the audience probably knows, that there are all kinds of scientists out there that are just about there, you know, but they're too afraid that they'll lose their job, they'll lose their funding, they'll be laughed at.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need some brave people to get out there and say, hey, yeah, hair samples came back and there's nothing in the animal kingdom that they match.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the point of fact that I bring up all the time is Magellan. Until Magellan, there were a couple societies that said, sure, the earth is round. You know, here's some math, stuff like that. Other than that, like, if you said the earth was round, buddy, you were driven out of your village. You were lit on fire in public as an example. Like, that was witchery to say that, until Magellan actually, went around the world. And then suddenly there's a conversation to be had now. And that was all of, 1500s, you know? So for the greater majority of humanity, the just accepted 10,000 years that we've been around, for the greater majority of that, no, man, Earth is flat. And it's a conspiracy theory to say otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's really what we're up against right now, is who is willing to be the Magellan? Who is willing to go out there with the evidence at hand and just forge forward, like you said?
Yeah. Yeah, we need more Meldrums and Grover Krantzes.
Absolutely.
And, you know, some of these guys that have a lot of respect in the scientific community.
I was going to mention real quick, too, Brett, we need more filmmakers that step out and break down the Patterson-Gimlin footage. Where are the James Camerons? Where are the Spielbergs that are breaking down the UFO footage? They know better. And I don't understand why their voices aren't present.
Yeah.
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 And
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and I had some friends, because this was, we've been narrative filmmakers, you know, filming scripts that we had written ourselves. Sure. I had friends come to me and say, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to make a Bigfoot documentary?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, absolutely. Because I believe 100%. I'm not worried. You know, this is a conversation that needs to be had.
Well,
and it's long overdue.
I thank you for that, because once again, it's hard. It's hard to come forward even artistically and say this is what I want to do. Because what about the other film projects that you have? What about the films that you're working on with those dudes? And what about the funding for them? And what will people think about that? And it takes a lot of quite literal chutzpah for you guys to have utterly financed this yourselves, to put it together yourselves, and to bring it out. So congratulations on that, and huge,
thank you,
huge kudos, because once again, it's not something a lot of other people that have put out a lot of other documentaries about UAPs, stuff like that, have incredible backing machines with them, you know, and there are some names that I could name. I won't name them. But they're major and they're out there.
Yeah.
Not so the case with Bigfoot documentaries typically. And the fact that you guys have put forth the effort to do this in the way that you have, and to do it in the open-minded way that you have, amazing job.
Thank you.
Before we let you guys go, I want to thank you for coming on, telling your stories, letting us into the mind of the creators here. All too often we get some questions, stuff like that, but we don't really get to deep dive into why somebody believes what they believe and why they actively made a passion project like this. So before we let you guys go, y'all can toss a quarter But it is time for shameless self-promotion on Curious Realm. So take it away, guys. Let everybody know where they can go to purchase the documentary, where they can go to support your efforts, where they can go to find out the latest from the A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed.
So I'll go quick here. A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed is out pretty much anywhere that you rent or purchase streaming products: iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Google Play, Xbox. You can rent it on YouTube. And then I also want to add, too, this is not something we've publicly announced yet, but we have started a Kickstarter campaign because we ran out of money after doing the first one. So we started a Kickstarter campaign to finish the second film, The Paranormal Bigfoot. And if the easiest way to do that is to type in A Flash of Beauty Kickstarter, and you'll find the page. And you know what? Every single dollar helps. You know, doesn't matter. If you guys want to help support us and you like what we're doing and you want to see more of it, then it would be fantastic to get your support. The other way you can support us, if you can't do it that way, is just telling people about it. You know, telling people about it, posting about it, and getting the word out there about the film.
Absolutely. Well, we will definitely be heralding it and shouting it from the mountaintops with our audience. We love people that are putting out media about these topics and trying to bring the conversation to light. So thank you guys so much for your time today. Thank you so much for your artistic efforts and your personal endeavor in making A Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed.
You're welcome. Thanks, Chris. Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you're online checking out everything about A Flash of Beauty, as well as the Kickstarter for A Flash of Beauty, Paranormal Bigfoot, please do not forget to stop on by and visit Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go for all of our episodes. Join us on Facebook, Curious Realm. You can go to CuriousRealm.com/live to watch the episodes live. If you go /247, you will actively find our 24/7 feed, which will rifle up a random piece of content for you from Curious Realm and keep randomly playing episodes. I think that we are somewhere close to about 80 hours of content right now. So plenty of stuff. Stop on by, check it out, CuriousRealm.com. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content, or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.